These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
What's left in your fridge? Have you put together a leftover turkey sandwich in the last couple of days? Was that tofurkey a hit this year? Got any pie left? We know that Thanksgiving and other holidays are filled with pieces of things that are meaningful to us. A family recipe, a prayer you say every year, the way you eat your leftovers. Well, these meaningful pieces, that's the subject this hour on Kids These Days. We're bringing back some of your favorite Kids These Days pieces. We'll hear about a young woman overcoming challenges, from boys reflecting on manhood, a story about keeping the Yupik language alive, and a favorite recipe from Chef KTD, and many more memorable pieces this hour. Welcome to Kids These Days, I'm Shanna Sheehy. Today we're stitching pieces of previous shows together with a nod to the holidays and a look back to the subjects we've covered since this show's debut. In radio, we like to talk about driveway moments, those times when listeners can't get out of the car because they're so engrossed in a story they're listening to. Well, we can't know whether that's happened for you because of Kids These Days, but we do know what stories have interested you most through our website and social media. So today, you, our listeners, have guided the pieces for this program. And first up, a story about a courageous young woman who is overcoming challenges right now as we speak. We first aired this profile of a young woman named Hannah a couple of months ago. At first glance, people often mistakenly categorize Hannah as a person who wouldn't be able to function either mentally or physically. She was born with cerebral palsy and has been in a wheelchair her entire life. But today, Hannah's attending her first semester at the University of Washington. Kids These Days contributor Ann Kaiser talked with Hannah and her parents when she was preparing to leave home for the first time.
Hannah is small. Her arms slightly waver and her head moves subtly but continuously as she sits in her high-tech power wheelchair. Seeing this can be intimidating and sometimes gets in the way of strangers getting to know her.
Or, for example, a lot of kids and even adults are scared to come up to me and ask me a question because they're afraid I'll be offended or something like that.
But she hopes once people find out it's okay to ask her questions and talk to her, that they'll learn something. Her dad sees it happening all the time.
I mean, people see Hannah coming. She's in a wheelchair, and there's a bit of pity that comes out or concern. And then when she opens her mouth or, you know, turns in a project, everybody's just continually blown away.
Because Hannah knows she has to put herself out there and to use her voice as an advocate for herself. Her parents, Mark and Janet, taught her that.
She's not given any assistance she doesn't ask for. At the same time, when she asks for something that we know darn well that she can do, we don't do it for her. We make sure she puts forth the effort to get the stuff she can done.
Between her father and myself and the rest of the family, we've always been very supportive of her to do things on her own. Just from day one, there's nothing you can't do. Just do it your own way. You need help, we're right here, but you're going to do this.
So in recent years, they've wanted her to manage her own schedule and try to be as independent as possible. It doesn't always work out. Sometimes, even after making call after call, her staff doesn't show up or she's left waiting for public transportation. But she doesn't give up. Now that she's heading off to college, there's even more for her to do.
I had to coordinate travel, doctors, where I was going to live, figuring out how to get around, figuring out school, how to get, therapy and exercise, and also how to relax a little bit and have some fun.
One of her favorite parts of this process was finding out about her brand new dorm room, because everything about it is accessible, something she's never had.
I'm so excited. They have modified a double room to make it accessible. They put in a couple of extra railings and so that I can be more independent with getting up and moving myself from place to place, as well as an accessible shower and bathroom that's huge, and everything is electronically secured.
Hannah also helped arrange the transfer of one of her personal staff, Shauna Lowe, to join her in Seattle. She's been helping Hannah for almost a year now with things like personal care, lifting and transferring her when needed, and companionship.
I just kind of go in, tell her, okay, this is what we need to do to get done. This is what I know you need to do. And then after that, in between everything, we sit there and just have fun.
Hannah knows this process of becoming independent has been good for her, but she can't help getting frustrated sometimes, especially when her dad said he wouldn't sign off on her scholarship a few days before the deadline.
You know what? I don't care if he says I have to wait another year. I'm not going to let this opportunity go away. It's too good, and it's too meant to be. So I looked at the form. I said, wait a minute. It doesn't need a signature. The only signature it needs on here is mine. So I signed it, and I went and mailed it off.
I wasn't going to let her accept the financial help without all her ducks in a row. When she said she wanted to go away to school, she can go anywhere she wants if she does it. Because when she gets there, it's with her issues, she can't just call mommy or daddy and get it fixed.
As much as she struggles with the pressure of her day-to-day life, Hannah recognizes she wouldn't be where she is today if she didn't believe that anything's possible.
No matter what anyone says, whether my family, my teacher says you can't do it, well, no, you just gotta find another way.
Her parents say it will be scary to watch Hannah go off to this strange new city, but neither one will show their fear. Instead, they'll try to let go and trust in her and everything they've taught her.
The road is so wide open for this kid, this young woman, and Seattle's going to be fantastic for her, but she's going to exist in this world just along with everybody else and excel. And I'm very proud of her for that.
We've tried to tell her, and, you know, we are hard at home, and we butt heads, but just how proud we are, all of us, how awestruck we are in what she's accomplishing, and how much we love her.
Hannah's first day of class is the 28th of this month. She's making her way towards her dream job of writing a travel blog to document accessibility and social issues around the world. For Kids These Days, I'm Ann Kaiser.
This piece first aired on our program about special education in Alaska. One of our favorite programs was the one we called Dads These Days. It aired in February of last year and had a second run in the summer months. For the program, we wondered what today's boys think about being dads someday, about what it means to be a man in the new millennium. To find out, Kids These Days contributor Ben Anderson put together an interesting piece. He asked Anchorage high schoolers about manhood. When do you become a man? How do men provide for their families? Will you make more than your wife someday? Would you be a stay-at-home dad? Here's Ben with those answers.
I'm Eric, and I'm 17.
I'm Aaron, and I'm 17 years old.
My name's Grayson.
And you're?
18.
Tyler, age 15.
I'm Marquise, and I'm 16.
I am Blake, and I'm 15.
Zach, I'm 15.
When do you think that you become a man? Do you think that it's a certain time in your life, or do you think it's an experience that you go through, or what do you think makes a man today?
I think going to college is where it really starts, and then after that, after I graduate, I think that's the beginning. For me, after I get out of high school, I think that's when I become a man.
Basically, when you go off to college, you become a man, and you gotta start being a person in society that can deal with their problems without outside help.
I don't know. Pretty much, yeah, probably age 18, I'd say. Or 21, I guess.
How do you think men provide for their families today? Is it the same as it was in the past, or do you think that role is changing a little bit?
Yeah, because a long time ago, I think it was more the man's job to only do work, and the women would just stay home and cook and deal with the children. But I think that now it's more common for both the male and the female to get a job. So I think that they both have to provide emotional support.
Well, from my family, it's kind of my dad's doing most of the work. You know, most of my mom's usually mostly at home. And she does work, but she's the one kind of takes care of us. But I think from what I've seen, or from what I expect from myself, is that I want to be able to spend more time with my kids. I want to have that job. And as I've seen things change, my wife is going to be more into her career as well. And I think we're both going to be playing a role more in the family.
Do you think it will be equal, that role, or do you think it will be favored one way to the other?
I want it to be equal. I don't want my kids to just have a stronger relationship, you know, with their mom.
The supportive aspect of a man is way different now. Women these days are wanting to become a lot more independent. A lot of them are not trying to be housewives. So a lot of them want to feel like they can do their own thing, create their own job. So I guess it's mutual. Today, men share that responsibility.
If you get married someday, do you expect to make more money than your wife, or do you hope to make more money than your wife?
I don't know. It depends, because I'm very competitive, and I don't like to lose at all. So I really think I'd take it real seriously, and I have to win.
Would you be willing to be a stay-at-home dad if it comes to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, as long as someone's bringing home enough money for everyone, then I'd be fine doing whatever, as long as I'm having a good time.
You know what? I would not want to do that.
Why not?
I don't know. I'm just not a stay-at-home kind of guy.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to stay at home either. I like to be active, get out of the house.
Have a job, you know.
Yeah.
I can honestly say I couldn't. Just for the fact I'm up and about every single day. I mean, but if it came down to that where that's how it had to be for the safety or whatever the situation may be, I would, but I would probably take those kids somewhere with me to get some physical activity going.
Keep busy.
Yeah, keep busy. I can't, because I honestly, I don't want to put myself in some of the women's shoes who just have to stay at home all day and just raise their kids like that.
Those were the thoughts of some teenage boys at Service High School in Anchorage. You're tuned into Kids These Days on your locally supported public radio station. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and today we're revisiting some favorite pieces from past shows. In August, we had a conversation about deaf and hard of hearing kids. We learned about statewide educational resources and talked with Rachel Coleman, who produces a series of popular sign language videos for little kids. We also aired this story. Did you know that on average, deaf kids who've graduated from high school read at a fourth grade level? American Sign Language is a completely different language than spoken English, so it's understandable that children whose mother's tongue is ASL may have trouble in traditional schooling environments where lessons are taught in English. One of the biggest challenges in deaf education is confronting literacy issues, but as we'll hear in this next story, graduate-level research and modern technology are seeking to close the reading gap for hearing-impaired students. Kids These Days producer Sarah Gonzalez has more.
At the Linguistic and Assistive Technologies Laboratory, or LATLAB, at the City University of New York in Queens, Lab Director Dr. Matt Unerfouth is studying how to produce software that would generate animations of sign language for the deaf and hearing impaired population. There is a need for this type of technology because for those who have been deaf their whole life, reading written English, like in subtitles or captions, can be a challenge.
So I think the statistic is that the majority of deaf high school graduates in the U.S. have a fourth grade reading level in written English lower.
So why is this? Dr. Unerfouth says that being deaf affects the ability to read written language because, as an infant or baby, language is primarily picked up through speaking and listening to parents talk, and while hearing these sounds, learning to place them into a context of meaning. But for children with hearing impairments, their ability to learn through this process is interfered with, and it significantly affects their literacy rates later in life. Plus, American Sign Language and written English are two totally different languages.
They have a different word order, a different linguistic structure, so you really can be fluent in one and have significant difficulty with the other. And because there are so many deaf adults that have difficulty reading English text, just because text is provided as a transcript for a video or the English text is there on the web page, the reading level of that text may actually be too high for them to actually be able to understand the content. For those adults, the way to make that information accessible would be to translate it into sign language.
The LATLAB is working on just that, developing avatars that translate English text into on-screen animations of American Sign Language. This type of software already exists. However, the existing technology is only programmed to translate static text. It wouldn't be able to pick up on minor changes that occur later. So this new software would be able to keep up with website edits.
So just in the same way that you could change a few words on a web page if something needs to be updated, if you were also providing an animation of the information on that web page in the form of a sign language character, you could edit the script that the character is performing just as easily as you could edit a few words on a web page, and then the content would be able to stay in sync, and you would still be able to provide information in a way that's easier to understand for someone who is deaf, who may have more fluent skills in American Sign Language than they may in terms of their reading literacy in English.
But perhaps the most significant criticism towards this type of existing technology is how it has trouble conveying the more subtle grammatical structures that exist within ASL, such as how pronouns, like he or she, modify verbs. Dr. Unifouth explains.
If I was talking about two friends of mine, John and Mary, and I pointed to the right and associated that location with John, and I pointed to the left and associated that location with Mary, if I wanted to say that John gives something to Mary, there's a sign for that in American Sign Language. There's a word for give. But instead of just performing it the way you'd see in a sign language dictionary, I'd actually customize the sign, and I'd move the location of the sign from the location of John and toward the location for Mary, so that embedded in the way that I perform the word give is actually the idea that it's John giving something to Mary.
Much of the meaning in ASL exists in space, or where the hands are signing a particular idea and in relation to those being spoken about and those being spoken to. You can see how this type of technology would be so difficult to develop, right? So how are they developing it?
What we do at the laboratory is we also use motion capture technologies. Similar to how if you have a Nintendo Wii, they have a controller that can detect your movements. If you had enough sensors like that placed on a person's body, you can digitize the way that they move. And so at our laboratory, we have people who are signers and have been using sign language their whole life, will come to the lab and perform different sentences. For example, they might perform verbs, like the verb give I mentioned before, and they would perform different versions of it for different ways that it would move through space. We would collect all of that data of the different ways that they perform signs, the way that one sign blends into the next, and then we analyze the movements to look for patterns, so that later when we want to produce animations of American Sign Language, we can use those statistical patterns that we saw in people's movements to guide the way that our animated character moves.
Here in Alaska, many types of adaptive technology are being used in the classroom to assist hearing impaired students. Kayla Parks is the Director of Disability Support Services at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Her department arranges for classroom interpreters and also stocks an assortment of assistive technologies for students and professors to use in the classroom. Their mission is twofold. They accommodate disabled students in their learning, and they also share their resources with others throughout the state.
The Anchorage School District, the Matanuska Borough School District, up in Fairbanks, we've had some great connections with K-12. And we also serve as a resource for the other campuses within the UA system.
The DSS office has a role of real live people who are available to take notes and to interpret for students within the classroom. In addition to these real people, they also have a large inventory of assistive technologies. There's the Pocket Talker, which delivers amplified audio to the user's earbuds. There are FM systems that are a direct link between a professor's microphone and a student's hearing aids. Or there's the Typewell, a text-based system that requires a human transcriber, as well as teletypewriters and video phones. For Parks, she says that all these technologies are about providing choices for disabled students.
By and large, individuals who are deaf probably still want to have a live person interpreting a lot of the time. But knowing that you can also use your cell phone to send a text message, that you can also use your iPad to have an ASL conversation with a relay operator who's then voicing on your behalf. That's nice. It's good to have options. So technology presents us with more choices.
So whether it's watching avatars interpret YouTube videos online or grasping the meaning of a biochemistry lesson through handheld audio amplification, the technology these days provides many choices for the deaf and hearing impaired to grow, learn, and to engage with the world. I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
Sarah posted photos from Dr. Unifau's lab on our website for this story. Check those out, as well as the full shows linked to the ones we're choosing from today. That's all at kidsthesedays.org.
Why are you telling me my new philosophy? The teacher gave a D on last week's homework. She said, Miss Sally Brown, your grades are going down. I could have told her my new philosophy, Miss B, I'm she. Look, see, a D, a D. Well, why are you telling me? And that's my new philosophy.
Shania Moore is 18 years old, and she graduated from Juno Douglas High School this year. While a student there, Shania was a regular up on the JDHS theater stage. She took part in school musicals and played Evita, the starring role in the production of the same name. She may not be on that same stage this year, but she is still singing. She works with the elderly and sings to them at an adult daycare center. She's saving up money to start theater school in Texas after the new year. I spoke with Shania this summer about what got her into singing, her favorite roles, and what she thinks her future holds.
When I was very, very young, I heard a song on the radio, and we were just happening to listen to a classical song, and I looked up the song because I loved it so much, and it turned out to be Papa, Can You Hear Me? From Yentl, and I looked it up, and the first person I found was Charlotte Church, a Welsh child singing. Yeah, she was 12 years old at the time, I think around that age, and I just went nuts. I started buying all of her CDs, and every song I listened to was just amazing, and I just wanted to be her so bad, and I used to pray when I was little, please let me be a soprano, please let me be a soprano, and sing those high notes, and I used to learn all of the Italian and Spanish. Anything she sung, I would make the sounds to sound exactly like the way it was, so I really felt like I was singing with her, and that was kind of like the birthplace of my interest in it.
To see, I hope that he turns out to be someone to watch over me.
My mom is a theater teacher at JDHS, and my father is the choir teacher at JDHS, and I was really into both of their programs, mostly because they were my parents, but then something happened that just sparked my interest in, and I love it now. It's, you know, it's a part of me. I can't get away. I sing constantly all day long, and sometimes it annoys my coworkers, but they enjoy it and all that kind of stuff.
He may not be the man some girls think of as handsome. To my heart, he carries the key.
The first lead part, the first actual lead part I got, rather than a backup character or just a character who's every once in a while on stage, was Evita. I watched every single thing I could possibly watch on her, and I did all my research. I practically became her when I auditioned, because I knew her so well. And then that makes me explore all of my characters like that. And I just found this love for knowing and honoring another person through acting, and even if they weren't real, but the idea of that person, you know, and the creator. It's just, it's wonderful to be able to portray someone else's whole life for someone else and just take them to a new place and help them explore a different world. It's unlike any other feeling.
Running around, trying everything new, but nothing impressed me at all. I never expected it to. Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is, I never left you. All through my wild days, my mad existence, I kept my promise. Don't keep your distance.
It's called Sam Houston State University in Texas, and it just so happens that all my family live in Texas except for my immediate family, and the program's just amazing. It's probably one of the best musical theater schools in the South, and then I get to be close to my family and my grandparents who haven't seen me for a while, and And so I'm planning to go there in the spring quarter. I need a little more cash, so I'm going to stay here and work at my job for during the fall. And then for the spring, I'm going to go to school and as a theater student, and then I'm going to try out for the musical theater program. It's a very hard program to get into, but I'm not too worried about it. I'm a little worried about it, but not too worried about it. I know I'll be led to the right place, and I'll go there either as a theater or musical theater student and work my little tushy off and do everything I possibly can and audition like crazy. I've been giving a lot of advice, getting a lot of advice from some friends of mine who say, you have to audition. I mean, the only way to do this is to audition, audition, audition. And then if you don't get it, keep walking, you know, face the sandstorm and just keep auditioning and don't get pulled down by stuff. And then once you get a part, invite agents to come see it. And then my ultimate goal is to be on Broadway one day, which is or isn't going to happen. But either way, I'll be happy as long as I'm on stage. Won't you tell him, please, to put on some speed? Follow my lead. Oh, how I need someone to watch over me.
Juno's Brian Wallace helped with audio for this story. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and you're listening to Kids These Days. Today, we're showcasing pieces from past programs that you, our listeners, told us you like the best. This program is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. We record in the Anchorage studios of KSKA-FM and are distributed by the Alaska Public Radio Network. We thank both of those organizations for their support and partnership. You are listening to Kids These Days on listener-supported public radio stations in Anchorage, Unalaska, Prudhoe Bay, Dillingham, and Juneau. After a quick break, we're back with stories about marketing to girls, perpetuating UPIC, achieving wellness, and making great chocolate treats. Stay with us. In the meantime, here's a song from Alaska teen musician Cela Reese. She played for Kids These Days on a previous program.
Walking down the street and I hardly know you anymore. It seems to me that you've forgotten what you're living for. I stop you on the street and I look straight into your green eyes. All I see is one big hole filled with empty lies. What you living for? Oh, what you living for? Oh, why do you hide? Why do you hide? Go, where's your heart? You seem to have lost it along the way. Go, where's your smile? Don't you know that there are better days? There are better options when push comes to shove. Just look into his eyes, can't you see the love? He loves you, loves, he loves you, loves, he can't hide. So why do you hide? Remember when you were young, such an unbroken heart. Remember when you trusted everyone. Memories, they're all just memories.
Probably in seventh grade or so, I had one teacher that just inspired me to learn to play music, because when I started, when I was like seven, my parents made me play piano because they were like, oh, Cela's so smart, you know, she needs something to challenge her. So they made me learn to play piano and I hated it. Then that one teacher changed everything for me when he taught me that music was so much more than just black notes on a white page. It was an emotion that laid within each and every note and every song. It was a story, and I was just like inspired that truly this was an incredible way to communicate, and it could touch your heart in places that words just couldn't. Excuse me, just couldn't.
Now you're afraid to take just one more chance. Is your heart still beating anymore? Oh, is your heart still beating anymore? Oh, don't you wanna feel? Don't you wanna feel what you're living for? Oh, what you living for? Oh, why do you hide? Oh, why do you hide? 'Cause he loves you, loves, he loves.
why do you hide? What you living for? Oh, what you living for? Oh, what you living for? What you living for? What you living for?
Divorce doesn't have the social stigma it once did, and today, half of all marriages end in divorce. What does all this mean for families, for kids, for finances, and everyday living? Next time on Kids These Days, we talk divorce with guests who counsel couples through it. Also, the 411 on what Alaska law says about ending marriages, and a little on single parenting. Join us for that and more next time. I'm Shanna Sheehy. This is Kids These Days. It's the week after Thanksgiving, and to recognize the pieces that come together for us all to make the holidays, we're revisiting some of our favorite stories from past programs. You took part in our selection. Our list is made mostly from the top stories at kidsthesedays.org. So without further ado, to observe Independence Day, Kids These Days explored what it means to be an American kid. That conversation with national and state representatives of the Kids Count effort was super interesting, and within it, KTD's own Jessica Cochran looked at how today's American kid is the target of a lot of marketing. Each new kid movie comes with a whole line of merchandise, from toothbrushes to cereal boxes to bathing suits. The Disney princess phenomenon, especially, has been the subject of much parental hand-wringing. Jessica herself is the daughter of a Barbie-loving feminist economist and the mother of a not-too-girly daughter, so she took a closer look at this whole princess thing by speaking with people at the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood and others.
Yes, my daughter chose a folder with the Disney princesses on it for her kindergarten school year, but truth be told, she didn't know which one was which without help from her more movie-savvy friends. We don't live in a media blackout, but we don't watch television with commercials, and only occasionally videos. Still, we go to the grocery store, where princess-imprinted merchandise is mixed in with the fruits and veggies. It's just this marketing-saturated world that the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood is fighting against. Psychologist Dr. Susan Lin founded the group in 2000 after watching two decades of monumental growth in the ways kids were marketed to. She says in 1983, companies spent $100 million a year advertising to kids. Now it is $17 billion.
Marketing is a factor in so many problems facing children today. Childhood obesity, eating disorders, precocious sexuality, youth violence, family stress, materialistic values, the erosion of children's creative play, which is the foundation of learning and creativity and constructive problem solving.
The campaign now has 45,000 members and works on issues like banning advertising from school buses and fighting the educational claims of videos like the Baby Einstein series. Lynn says kids play less creatively with media-linked toys, especially the ones with their own computer chips that talk and make noises. And she doesn't like the message being fed to kids and parents that they need to buy something to play a character, the official Spider-Man costume or the Harry Potter wand. She says these days there is little programming for kids that isn't also trying to sell them something. Still, she acknowledges that television and movies played an important role in her own creative life as a child, something she struggled with when writing her book, The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized
World.
And
it took me a while. I wrestled with it, and I realized that there was a big difference, and the difference is access. That today, when I saw, for instance, the movie Peter Pan in the movie theater when I was 6 years old, and that triggered years of fantasy play for me, I only saw it once. But kids today see these movies over and over and over again. And so if I wanted to visit the world of Peter Pan and evoke those incredible feelings that the movie engendered in me, I had to play. It was the only way that I could do that. But today, if a child is enamored of a movie, they can just see it over and over
and
over.
But Dan Cook says we should give kids more credit. Even with repeat viewings, he thinks kids find their own meaning in what they see, not just what is fed to them. He's an associate professor of childhood studies at Rutgers University in Camden, New Jersey, and he thinks to understand the princess obsession, you have to understand why it's so appealing.
The idea of girls in particular at a particular age looking for something in their own lives, meaning with their siblings or with their friends or in the context of their families, that they can call their own, that they can see is something that speaks to them and that it belongs to them.
Girls gain some sense of identity around it. They see their place in the larger world, and it feels independent because it doesn't come from their parents. He understands why the overarching damsel in distress themes trouble some parents, but says it would be difficult to figure out how to study the effects on kids.
The more difficult question really comes down to what's the sort of displacement effect of having all of these images and all of these narratives and stories and goods and that are culminating. You know, what is this crowding out that perhaps parents want to do, want to fill it with something else?
His basic advice, moderation. Being a princess should be like a costume that can be taken on and off and not something kids can't give up. Indiana University Assistant Professor Karen Woolwind says kids work through the princess texts, as she calls them, through play. She did a 3-year study of kindergarten classes, watching how kids used creative play in classrooms. When kids were allowed to play with their princess toys, they quickly found the limitations in the stories.
And so I saw in one case, one little girl was writing a play about Sleeping Beauty, and she was also directing the play. So in the process of directing the play, she is shouting out directions to people and telling them where to stand and, you know, going over and demonstrating how she wants things done. And that's really difficult to do when you're also playing the lead of Sleeping Beauty and you're trying to lay there totally still in 100 years sleep.
By the end, the little girl had taken the sword away from the prince and was fighting off the dragon herself. Woolwind says by not allowing kids to bring in or play those popular media toys, educators are leaving the interpretation to the media moguls instead of helping kids work through them, negotiate roles with their peers, and often come to resist those storylines on their own. Woolwind originally set out to study how kids used creative play in developing literacy skills, and what she saw was a little surprising.
Classrooms where children were the most deeply engaged in reading and writing were classrooms where they were able to bring in the popular media toys that they really loved, because these toys come with storylines and characters that are very rich.
Letting kids use those characters, their areas of expertise, made them more enthusiastic writers as well.
We often find children are saying things like, I don't know what to write about. I don't have anything to say. And what they're really saying is, I don't have anything to say about what you want me to write about in this moment. But when we turn the tables and try to see what children are already expert at and what they really care about, many times that's the media that they are living in. They're immersed in it. And so then if we ask them to write about what they're expert in, they have lots and lots to say and lots of resources to draw on. So I'm hoping we can begin to see these things as literacy resources that have real impact for children's developing reading and writing skills.
She thinks it's more productive to engage with the popular media storylines that are out there than to try to avoid them. Her current work is using new media with preschool teachers to help kids rewrite and take over those storylines at younger ages. I'm Jessica Cochran.
If you want to know and read more about this, we link to several organizations, books, and other publications on the topic from kidsthesedays.org. Way back when Kids These Days first began, I spoke with Dr. Patricia Kuhl when she was in Alaska. Kuhl is internationally renowned for her research on the infant brain and early language acquisition. She does her work at University of Washington's iLabs, that's its Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences. On that program, our producer Sarah Gonzalez put together the following piece. She spoke with Abby Augustine in Bethel. Augustine is the Yupik Language Education Specialist for the Lower Kuskokwim School District. She told Sarah about the fun ways she gets kids excited to speak their traditional language.
Those of us who took high school French or Spanish might not remember much more than sitting in a classroom endlessly conjugating verb tenses or memorizing phrases for which we may have never encountered a context. Vamos a la discoteca, anyone? But what if second languages were taught much in the same manner in which we acquire first languages, through listening and associating actions or objects with words in the actual context in which they are used? That furry thing brother is calling to must be dog, and this white liquid that I'm offered every day must be milk. There is a teaching method that does exactly this, and it's called Total Physical Response Storytelling, or TPR storytelling for short, and it's being applied in classrooms to successfully teach children native Alaskan languages. Abby Augustine is a Yupik language education specialist for the Lower Kuskokwim School District. She trains teachers in teaching Yupik, but before she did this, she spent 13 years as a first and second grade teacher at a Yupik immersion school in Bethel, where she incorporated the TPR storytelling method into her classroom lessons.
Well, there's three basic steps that are followed in the TPR model. The first step being teachers demonstrating actions several times and give directions while waiting for the children to follow along. And then the second step being where you hesitate and pause to see if the children will follow the directions without you. Then if they don't do that, then you continue demonstrating. And then the last step being more like a test to see if they've made the connection with the words and meaning by not doing the action yourself and just giving the verbal directions. Then if they're not ready, then you continue repeating.
Total Physical Response was originally developed by James Asher, a professor of psychology at San Jose State University. It is based on the premise that children can best learn a second language according to the same code-breaking principles employed while learning their first language, that is, observing an action while hearing the word for that action.
Instead of just learning hungry, just as a word, I might use my hand and, you know, make a circular motion on my around my tummy area, and then, you know, they associate that me making a circular motion around my tummy, and they know that I'm using the word hungry. So there's that association.
Augustine applied this method in her classroom through the use of storytelling, a tradition that is both well-established within the Yupik culture and also fun for young children because they get to move around and act like characters in a story.
I decided to try it in my classroom, and that was the year that I tried it. I had quite a successful year with my students, and then on top of it, we had fun doing it because many of these short stories have, you know, funny endings, and so it was so perfect. You know, we like to have humor in the Yupik culture, and that humor kind of lessened their stress level to use the language.
The children learn very short and humorous stories like this one about a wolf and a little bird. The wolf is hungry, and he sees a little bird. He approaches the little bird, and then the bird hands him a sandwich. The humor in a story like this one, instead of eating the bird as we'd expect, the wolf eats a sandwich, especially appeals to the kids.
So I have a gesture for the wolf, you know, making claws and a mean-looking face, and then I flap my hands like I'm a little bird. Una kadam jiguk gulunuk kailra. Sami gulunuk tanktuk. Gulunuk kaihtuk. Gulunuk tanktuk yakul yagamuk. Gulunum dulaga yakul yagak. Yakul yagam chigira gulunuk sandwich yamuk. Guyana guluk.
The children hear a story such as that one on Monday, both in English and then in Yupik, and act out motions to go along with the words. They practice and then act out the story at the end of the week for fellow classmates and also for their communities.
Sometimes we'd, you know, go to the senior center to perform for the elders, and of course the elders were always ever so delighted to see, you know, the students acting these short stories out with a little chuckle.
These new language skills aren't only for performance. Augustine says that she often overhears her students using them in the hallways at school.
In one of our stories, we had a story about the baby, you know, the baby crying. And the my targets for that one story was the baby's crying, the baby is crying harder, so there's a progression of the baby crying louder and louder. So anyway, I was walking to the nurse's office that week, beginning of the school year, and my students were, you know, conversing with each other, and then they were using, you know, those particular vocabulary, you know, about crying, you know, how they weren't going to cry when they, you know, got their shot from the nurse. And anyway, they were using the terms correctly, so I was like so delighted.
Ultimately, says Abby Augustine, she and her colleagues at the Lower Kuskokwim School District are striving to fulfill a common desire among their community that the children graduate from high school proficient in both English and in Yupik.
In summary, I just want to share that TPRS, having taught TPRS in the classroom, is one fun way classroom teachers can help reverse language loss.
It's easy to listen to this whole program. Click on the Every Episode to Date link on the left side of our homepage. It's show number 2. Also at kidsthesedays.org, you can see a slideshow of Abby Augustine working with her students and find links to research on the TPR storytelling method of teaching language. Each week, Kids These Days takes on a new topic, and over time, we've tackled a variety of issues. Sometimes our topics are fun, sometimes they're practical, and other times they're serious. One issue we have talked about on several occasions is how Alaska is doing when it comes to protecting each other from domestic violence, intimate partner and sexual violence, child abuse, and neglect. In the spring, we brought you this story about the Family Wellness Warriors Initiative. The Family Wellness Warriors Initiative has an ambitious goal: end domestic violence, child sexual abuse, and child neglect in Alaska in this generation. It's a program of South Central Foundation, the native nonprofit healthcare organization for the Cook Inlet region. And as Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran tells us, it's all based on sharing stories.
When South Central Foundation CEO Catherine Gottlieb started hosting a group of women from her church at her home, the 8 Alaska Native women opened up and shared their stories. It turns out they had one thing in common. They'd all been sexually abused as children, and they'd all been taught never to speak about it. That is just one of the experiences that led Gottlieb to start the Family Wellness Warriors Initiative.
I think about how tribal people chase out the tiger out of the woods or the lion, and they line up with their drums outside of the forest, and they all beat their drums, and it does chase that lion or tiger out of the woods. That's what I feel that we're doing in the state of Alaska. We're all lining up, we're getting our drums together, we're beating out domestic violence, child abuse, child neglect. It's going to stop.
The initiative's trainings are derived from a faith-based program from Michigan, SALT, Survivors of Abuse Leadership Training. It teaches survivors how to be group leaders, taking them through 12 different subject areas using Bible stories and spirituality. A committee here in Alaska attended that training and started figuring out how to bring it here and adapt it. They also needed to figure out how to support people who attended to deal with all the feelings that come from sharing painful stories. The whole program is based on breaking the silence and sharing those stories.
Behind everybody's eyes, there is a story. And the story that you have in your life impacts you about how you relate and what you do and how you live your life. And so if you know that about me, and I know that about you, and you're my provider, we might be able to understand each other better before you diagnose me and treat me for a behavioral problem or a physical problem as my doctor.
So every employee of South Central Foundation attends a core concepts training, and the philosophy behind Wellness Warriors has been incorporated into all 160 South Central Foundation programs. By now, more than 2,000 others have been through a training as well. Rick McCafferty is one of them.
And when I was able to talk more about my childhood story, what was revealed to me is the impact that was having on my family immediately. I had abandoned my wife in a strong way. I'm still married to her. Abandonment meaning letting her make all the decisions. I was a weak man. I hid behind her because I didn't want to make those decisions. And even though I swore I would never sexually abuse or physically abuse my children, my voice was very angry and very controlling, and I abused them in a different way. When I saw that as a man, I wept. And this was probably the first year I was starting to do this with them. And I thought, that's not who I want to be. That's not who they deserve. And so as I learned that I was impacting my family in the way I didn't want to, it made me become a stronger husband and a stronger father to be there for my children and to be there for my wife.
He's now a training specialist for the initiative. When McCafferty first became involved, only 8% of participants were men. McCafferty saw women leading this effort, and he saw how much they needed men to get involved.
What they came up with was a dance called Rise Up Mighty Warrior that Catherine and a lot of the women that are part of this dance to. And so they put on their regalia, they danced to this song, and what you've seen in these women is not just the physical beauty, but the beauty in their eyes and the pain that was in their eyes. And they challenged us men to take back our place as rightful protectors, the warriors that we used to be, and they asked us to rise up, to get involved. And so today we have 47% men answering the call in our conferences, because we've challenged the men, and the men are rising up and want to take their places back.
Some men have become involved in prison. The training is presented at the Palmer Correctional Facility for inmates who volunteer for it. Those who have gone through it have a much lower recidivism rate, 30%, versus the state average of 70%. The Family Wellness Warriors Initiative is spreading statewide. It's been presented in at least 7 regions. Some regions are involved in a 3-year process to tailor the trainings for their area and put on their own workshops to train more group leaders and community members to support people in their villages. South Central is also revising the curriculum to make it more culturally relevant and developing a new conference that isn't as based in the Bible. Catherine Gottlieb says they are working toward a day when any child who is abused will quickly speak up about it, because they'll find a safe and accepting listener, a safe place to go when they need it. By sharing stories, she says, they're putting abusers on notice. We won't be silent. We are telling. I'm Jessica Cochran.
Find out more about Family Wellness Warriors and other prevention efforts through kidsthesedays.org. You can also link there to previous shows we've produced on domestic violence and sexual assault and suicide prevention. Well, we've just about enough time for one last favorite Kids These Days piece. We bring you some regular features on the show, like Dr. KTD or KTD on the Go, The Power of One, or our When I Was Young reflections. Today, we end with your favorite Chef KTD. You voted with your clicks on our website. This is the recipe that got the greatest number of hits. So here's Liz Madsen and her 5-year-old son talking with KTD's own Sarah Gonzalez and showing how to make a delicious kid-friendly chocolate ganache.
We are going to be making ganache so that we can dip fruit in it or whatever you want. You can put bacon in it if you like.
Bacon. And so ganache is mostly chocolate?
Ganache is just cream and chocolate. It's basically a fancy fudge sauce.
Ganache, I haven't made ganache ever.
In the mixing bowl, I'm just going to put in, this is a 77% dark chocolate. You could use like a semi-sweet baking chocolate if you want. And then this is a 58% chocolate. So this is like your basic sweetened chocolate. Like you can just buy chocolate chips at the grocery store for the large portion of it, and then you can use the baker's bars for the other portion. It's 2 pounds of chips, which is the lighter stuff, to 6 ounces of the darker.
Okay.
And then we have a quart of heavy cream and 1 cup of corn syrup, and you're just gonna bring that to a boil and pour it in here and mix it, and that's it.
All right, that sounds really easy.
Super easy.
And then what do you do with the ganache when it's finished?
You can dip stuff in it, you can fill cakes with it, you can coat cakes with it,
or you can put candy in it.
You can put candy in it. Yeah.
Candy in it. Mm-hmm. So on that plate over there on the counter, Aiden, what's on that plate? What do I see?
Cherries and
marshmallows and strawberries and pineapple.
So, Liz, is this something that people can do with their kids at home? That's pretty easy.
Absolutely. It's very easy. It's nothing more than bringing cream to a boil and pouring it over chocolate. And you can use a mixer like I have here, or you can do it by hand either way, and you just let it sit.
And you're pouring the boiling cream. It just barely boiled, and now she's pouring it into a mixer with all of the chocolate.
That's it. And so the hot cream just melts all the chocolate, and then you just mix it until it's emulsified, and it's nice and shiny, and that's all.
How do you know when to stop?
When it's all mixed in, it'll become nice and dark and shiny. Once all the chocolate is melted. Multiple uses for it. You can dip stuff in it, fill things. There's a lot of different things you can do with it. So it's really easy. It's one of those things that's like four ingredients.
Is it all done?
That's all done. That's it.
How long did that mix for? Like a minute or two?
Yeah, maybe a minute.
Okay, so now it's hot and it's mixed. Do you have to wait for it to cool down, or do you want to dip the fruit when it's still warm?
You can do it when it's still warm. That way it's nice and liquid. And eventually it'll cool to room temperature, and it'll probably stay for, I don't know, and you could keep it in the freezer or keep it in the refrigerator for up to a month probably before it'll go bad.
What else could you dip in this?
Graham crackers, bananas, bacon.
And cherries.
Cherries. Mm-hmm. All kinds of fruit. Mm-hmm. It's good for
not these kind of cherries, like a party, the other red cherries.
Like a quick dessert, you know. You can just like have it on a buffet or something if you're going to throw a party. It's really easy. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, everybody can make their own. It's interactive. They can create like, oh, I like pineapple or I like strawberry. So you get to basically make your own dessert.
Well, that is just lovely. And so easy.
I found a marshmallow one. I have to try a lot of them so they taste good.
Yes, make sure that we did it right.
Yummy.
That Chef KTD first aired in February to mark Valentine's Day. You can see the awesome picture Sarah took while Liz cooked at kidsthesedays.org, as well as get the full recipe there too. It's officially the holiday season now, with Thanksgiving behind us and the new year coming right up. And it is the season of giving. So be sure to check kidsthesedays.org for ways to give back this holiday season. We'll keep a running list of opportunities there. If your organization has an event to share, email us the info and we'll post it online. Send it to mail@kidsthesedays.org. Thank you for joining me today on Kids These Days, where we took a stroll down memory lane together. Many people made today's show possible. Anne Kaiser and Ben Anderson reported from Anchorage. Brian Wallace assisted from Juneau. Jessica Cochran is this show's regular contributor and reported from Anchorage. She's also our assistant producer and technical editor. Sarah Gonzalez reported from Anchorage and is our producer, web content editor, and manager, and the woman who keeps up with the business end of things, too. Lost Lander is Matt Sheehy, and he is the man behind this program's original music. I'm your host, Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll see you next time.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.